You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, January 4th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Corey Robin, professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. On being against the politics of fear. Also on the program today, President Obama on the Hill to save the Affordable Care Act. Mike Pence, Vice President Electoral, on the Hill to destroy it, and more. Dems to go Garland on Trump's SCOTUS picks. That is, until the filibuster is gone. California hires Eric Holder to fight Trump. Bankers beware, JK. That's just kidding. I was taught that the other day by my daughter. Andrew Cuomo's slimy play for 2020. And Trump's Treasury Secretary accused of massive illegal foreclosure in California. The NAACP leaders stage a sit-in and get arrested in Jeff Sessions' office to protest his nomination as Attorney General. Donald Trump praises Julian Assange and attacks the U.S. intelligence apparatus. And Duncan Hunter has a rabbit, and apparently it flies around with him.
Duncan Hunter is the congressman?
Pretty sure.
That dude with the vape and the macho posturing is a rabbit? Oh, it's perfect. It's perfect. He goes, feeds the thing a carrot.
He's like, you know what? I'm not so hard after all. I inherited the seat from my dad. I never really knew what I wanted.
I know,
just wanted to look at Putin pictures and watch snuff movies.
Now I've lost the piece.
I got all this up.
All that and more on today's program. I've lost that Duncan Hunter piece about him traveling around with a rabbit. Apparently, I mean, this is the...
What's up, Doc? Get it? Get it? Ah, forget it.
Apparently, this is the fallout of the failure of the Republicans from destroying the independent ethics agency that worked with the Congressional Bipartisan Ethics Committee, is that all this stuff, that has come out about what people do, Duncan Hunter is out there arguing now that apparently because this committee looked into the charge that he had been using campaign funds to pay the $600 worth of cost in flying a family rabbit.
Imagine the rousing speech on the floor. It's like, who here amongst us, despite our deep disagreements on funding of health care, the social safety net, and how we defend our country, has not wanted to use public funds to fly a ferret across the country? Who among us would also not want to sexually harass many members of our staff?
Okay, now there he is. He's vaping on the floor. I think he just gets juiced up with that stuff. But the funny part about this story is that he is trying to argue this is a perfect example of how the ethics committee or the ethics office is involved in overreach. Now, of course, they didn't pursue that, I guess the $600, because he's had to reimburse his campaign for more than $60,000 in other expenses. I mean, this is the problem. They complain like, oh, look at the overreach in terms of the rabbit. Oh, and then, of course, they also got me with like $60,000 of other stuff. But what are you going to do?
Why are you attacking my family?
Why are these people so virulently anti-rabbit? So virulently anti-rabbit.
What I like that, too, is that might be the type of really random thing where Trump decides that he just doesn't like the guy. He's like, wait, his rabbit as a pet? No, I don't want that guy around.
Too soft. And they're like, that's just weird. They poops everywhere.
They're disgusting animals.
So last night, I was on, well, it was Chris Hayes' show, but it was Ari Melber was hosting. And they were, the angle of the segment was that this is a good thing. You know, we should take some solace in the fact that shame could actually work with these guys, these Republicans. And I'm not as sanguine about it. This was a rookie mistake that even Paul Ryan and McCarthy didn't want to do right up front. You know, you got to wait for them to be offering like a half a dozen other things that are actually going to fundamentally destroy our society. And then you sneak the ethics thing underneath the radar. But for whatever reason, they didn't do that. And I neglected on some level to say, and my argument is that we need to talk more about politics. And this we'll get into with Corey Robin, Robin, I should say. But one of the things that I think is going to be helpful for this, setting up this sort of narrative of how desperately they want to be able to be corrupt, is we're going to be looking at a bunch of nominees are going to come up in front of these committees. And now that the table is set, now that the tone is about corruption, it's quite clear. Look, I don't think anybody in the country would argue that Donald Trump does not have an ethics problem. There are a few ethical lapses, the few conflict of interests.
We actually have some sound of somebody that might question that
later.
Well,
all right, we'll play that. But it doesn't. He seems to be impervious to it because there's no checks and balances, right? There's no price for him to pay. With nominees, you're starting to involve congressmen and senators who don't seem to have the same luxury of being completely corrupt. And so this could be a good narrative going forward. We'll talk more about it as the show progresses, as the week progresses. But that was a long way of me saying I had to shave last night. And it's always rough when you come back from vacation, for me, because I don't shave when I'm on vacation.
Not at all.
Not at all. And I had a heavier beard, which actually, like a couple of days ago, I don't know why I did this. Maybe because it was just starting to itch me so much. I cut it down with my old head shaver that I used to cut my own hair.
I believe that.
And I've got some pretty serious pictures of like what looks like in the back. I've had electroshock therapy because of the huge patches.
It's like the guy in Full Metal Jacket who also studies Social Security.
I was just going like this, and I thought like, wow, that's really super smooth, and it turned out to be not so good. But the point is, after even like a week's worth of growth, Harry Shaver did me right. You know I love Harry's, and you know the primary reason, it's inexpensive and it's incredibly convenient. But I gotta say, I'm not a connoisseur of shavers, but I got to say, I always get a great shave with Harry's. And as you know, for decades, one big razor company, we're not going to say the name. We don't want to get in trouble. We started to pick a fight with these guys. Has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of their customers. So Jeff and Andy, the two guys who founded this company, started Harry's to fix shaving. And they knew there was only one way to ensure quality. They bought their own factory. By taking less profit and selling directly to you over the internet, Harry's offers their blades at half the price, just $2 a blade compared to $4 you'll pay at the drugstore. I'm telling you, it's someday in the future, people are going to look back at this time and say, like, people were paying $4 a razor. That's like the way that we look at people saying, like, the earth was flat. Harry's razors include everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade. In other words, like, it's a thinner, I guess, a thinner blade holder? I don't know what you call that device. The part where the blade sits.
Yeah, I understand.
Which is important.
If you got
some
nose
like some of us might have. They have rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover, which is good because blades are sharp. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they want you to try their shave set for free. That's right.
That's
you
insane.
Heard me right.
It's amazing.
For free. You just got to cover the shipping when you sign up.
Plus, as a special offer for fans of this show, go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout and get a post-shave balm also free. So you get a free thing and then another free thing at harrys.com, code MAJORITYREPORT.
The best.
So we'll get to this, but Obama apparently went on the Hill today, and CNN is reporting that Obama basically told the Democrats, don't give them a lifeline. Help them not one iota. When they repeal Obamacare, they're going to try and replace it with Trump care. It could be the exact same thing. But do not help them one iota. And I think this is good advice. I mean, can you imagine something worse than Obamacare?
Yeah.
Like, I'm saying that was not the way it was before.
Is there a way that they, I mean, some of the proposals floating around would be some version of Obamacare where they lower the subsidies and weaken the protections. There must be some ideas cooking
around.
Oh,
yeah.
Like that,
that's what
right?
I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's impossible to imagine. No, that's what it's going to be.
Okay, right, right, right. Gotcha.
But I'm saying it's going to be that much worse. Like, you're going you're going to have no Medicaid expansion for millions of people, no health insurance. And then you're going to lose a lot of the subsidies, you're going to lose a lot of the quality of the coverage. I mean, I don't know how they're going to do this. It's going to be a mess for them, and we can only hope. But
isn't it amazing that every proposal floating around, like the DC think tank apparatus from the Republicans on healthcare, it always just boils down to, like, somehow we'd make it worse.
Like, well, here's the thing. The dilemma they have is that it is about... If you accepted the premise, we need to have some type of health insurance reform as a Republican, the Affordable Care Act is what you would have come up with.
That's
now,
it.
The reality is they never wanted to have any health care reform. To the extent that they ever offered a plan in the past, and some of it is based upon this, certainly not the Medicaid expansion, but... The way the exchanges are set up, being market-based without a public option, that was basically a Republican plan that was floated to fight off Democratic proposals in the past.
That was Clinton's proposal, right? And that was the alternative to Clinton's proposal.
And Obama and really the Democrats, largely speaking, basically just adopted the Republican plan and said, how could they argue with this? Well, I'll tell you how they could argue with it, because they were not sincere.
And you're black.
And this is the other thing that I think, like, and we'll get into this with Corey Robin in a little bit, is that people are making the mistake of thinking that, like, I don't think people fully still, as I watch the commentariat, understand two things. One, Republicans don't give a crap. And two, Donald Trump gives a crap less. Like, he doesn't even, he's not, they presume, like, oh, they're, he should be worried about his nominee going up there and having a problem with this and that.
Mm.
Honestly, I don't think he cares.
I mean, actually, wait one second. Let me see if I care. Let me run it by Joey No Socks. Hey, Joey, do we care? Joey says no.
I don't think there's a single nominee that is going to be up there that he would even give, oh, that guy didn't get passed? I think he would just look for somebody who he thought was messing with him if it didn't get passed. But I don't think he would care, like, oh, that's rough on that guy, or I'm not going to get to implement my blankety-blank plans. I don't think he gives a crap.
Don't worry, guy that lost his job or whatever. We'll get revenge on the guy that lost you that job.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, stay tuned for my next pick on Twitter.
Right.
And also, Rosie Donnell, still disgusting.
Right, exactly. Honestly. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Corey Robin after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Corey Robin. He is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Book to Sarah Sarah Palin. And you can go back and search our archives for our interview about that book. Corey, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a piece on your blog, almost a month ago now, which I think is still quite relevant, against the politics of fear. I want to talk about that and obviously just sort of, you know, more broadly where we are now. I don't know that much has changed over that past month, but I guess short of the Electoral College. Actually voting, but tell us what you mean about the politics of fear.
The politics of fear is not just the use of intimidation or the fear of an external enemy in politics. What the politics of fear is when you ground your politics, when you find a really deep foundation for your politics in the fear of something. After 9/11, we saw this in the way in which the fear of radical Islam was used not only by the Bush administration, but also by a lot of intellectuals and journalists and pundits, both on the right and the left, as a way they thought of refounding politics in America, that suddenly we had a cause and a purpose, and suddenly we would find ourselves rejuvenated through this experience of fear. So the politics of fear is something really far more comprehensive. And what I was saying in that article was that we on the left need to be very careful as we start engaging in a politics of, you know, firm and intransigent opposition against Trump, that we not looked to that fear of Trump as the source of our politics, that our politics has to be grounded in a vision of overcoming Trump and Trumpism, and that we not find the deep roots of our cause in the fear of Trump.
So, all right, so let me back up. I mean, because this speaks to a dilemma that I still feel like I don't know if it's ever going to go away. But before we get to that dilemma that I've been wrestling with, so when if it's September and I'm saying I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils that I perceive it as, you know, between Clinton and Trump, because I'm afraid of a unified Republican government and, you know, a total incompetent narcissist who's could be a kleptocrat. Right. I mean, it's not that, right? You're talking about, or are
no,
you
not at all. Okay. And if anything, I mean, I would make a really strong distinction between what you just said and something like Hillary Clinton grounding the entirety of her campaign
right
in the evil that Donald Trump represents. And I mean, I think, if nothing else, what we've seen is the verdict on that kind of a politics is that it just does not take you that far. It can't get you across the finish line. So it's impractical and unrealistic. But more important, I think the bottom line is here we find ourselves now, which is, you know, why is the Democratic Party sort of flailing about? I mean, I compare the way the Republicans responded to the election of Obama, who, if you think about just in terms of numbers, was far greater repudiation of everything the Republicans stood for in terms of electoral victory than anything like what Trump has gotten. And what did they do? You know, within weeks, they were organizing the Tea Party and obstructing everything he did. And, you know, with the Democrats, the response has been, you know, I think just a far greater source of confusion, because in part because I think of the politics of fear.
Yes.
They don't quite know what it is that they stand for. And so therefore, they can't even quite figure out why they oppose Trump. And so we're sort of stuck in this paralysis right now. And I think, you know, we're seeing the effects.
Yeah, I mean, I found it very to be a huge problem that there was never a conversation about, like, hey, he's going to be the guy who's going to sign Paul Ryan's dream legislation. And you don't talk about that at all. It's just sort of this notion of this guy being a monster. And right. He is. But I mean,
and that's I think that's a really important point there in two senses. So first of all, there are a lot of very practical policies that are now being pursued, and we're not paying that much attention to them. So yesterday, you know, the Senate votes on a new set of rules that are going to enable them to sort of start beginning to overturn Obamacare.
Right. This is the resolution. We should just say this is the resolution essentially to that presages voting on these things via reconciliation, and
exactly
will allow essentially the pulling apart of the Affordable Care Act for anything that involves the government spending money.
Right. So, you know, there's that's happening. And so there's a lot of very specific things that we have to attend to. And that gets sort of overlooked when you're talking about things like monsters and you get caught up in the atmospherics of the tweets and all the rest of it. So that's one thing, and that's important. The flip side of that, though, is that when you start talking about Trump in this way, you can't see all the ways in which he's vulnerable and which the Republicans are vulnerable. And this is also important because fear, what fear does as an emotional experience and as a politics is it makes the power that wields the fear greater than it otherwise is.
Right.
It adds to power. And our job on the left is to strip away that power, to diminish it, to beat it back. And you can't do that if you're every day in and out talking about this monster. It just, you know, people get afraid. They're not going to, people don't move forward to fight when they're afraid. They tend to cringe and they fall back. And, you know, I've been really on social media trying to emphasize and point to all the ways in which I think the Republicans are vulnerable. You know, this is one of the lowest majority, popular majority they've ever been elected with. I mean, if you compare it to something like Richard Nixon and just plot the trajectory from Nixon to Reagan to George W. Bush, now to Trump, this is all a downward slope that they've been on, and it's long term. There are big divisions within them over trade. I mean, the whole battle over trade.
I want to put a pin in these vulnerabilities for a moment, because I want to just go back to that. Clinton sort of creating, you know, saying the primary argument was like, this guy's a monster, and not even on some level, like the only time the notion of him being a monster, like the rubber hit the road, was in the reflection of our children's eyes. And, you know, as opposed to like, hey, people aren't going to have health care. You're, right. you know, there's your drinking water is not going to be as clean, et cetera, et cetera. But what of her, the announcement yesterday, and I don't want this to turn into a bashing session, but is she doing the right thing by going to the inauguration? Because on one hand, it makes me feel like, look, you were up there saying the one argument you had was that this guy is beyond the pale, outside of the norm, completely unfit to be president, regardless of ideological differences we might have. On the other hand, it in some ways it's also, I mean, just you know, from the perspective that you're espousing, it's another way of saying like, look, okay. But the reality is he's there now, and we now have to address them through actual politics.
Yeah, actual politics, not attending his inauguration. That's not actual politics. I mean, I think it's important here on this issue. Go back to what she said in that second debate, right? She said, you know, with prior nominees, Republican nominees, I disagreed with them, but I never questioned their fitness to serve. Donald Trump is different. And then she went on to talk about the things he had said about women, and she says, I think it's clear to anyone who heard it that it represents exactly who he is. Words have to mean something. You know, we go on and on about the dangers of fake news and all the rest of it. What kind of message does it send when you articulate a rhetoric like that in one moment, and then you attend an inauguration in the next moment? I think part of normalizing Trump is also saying, we're not going to attend your inauguration. I think those two things are not inconsistent. And there's a precedent. John Quincy Adams never went to the inauguration of Andrew Jackson. I mean, if it was good enough for him, it should be good enough now.
So wait a second. So actually normalizing him is going to the inauguration or not going?
I think it's not inconsistent not to go to the inauguration and not normalizing him. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, because I was wondering, because on some level, it, you know, going to the inauguration, I think she shouldn't attend, frankly. I just don't see the point of it. But it is another way of saying, like, okay, we're now going to meet this guy head on. Now, I don't see any other evidence, though, of her doing any of that, frankly.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the real, I mean, to look to Clinton to lead this kind of a thing is obviously farcical. I mean, she's not going to. I mean, this election was a thorough repudiation, not just of her, but of all those people and who were around her. So it's almost beside the point to have a conversation about her and what she should be doing now.
All right. Well, let me ask you this, and then I want to go into those vulnerabilities because I think that's really important. But one of the concerns that I have is that, and I guess maybe I should start with by asking you this. Do you think that there is a danger with Donald Trump that is beyond what it would be with just say President Mike Pence?
You know, it's too soon to tell. My sense is not really. And if anything, I think this gets into the vulnerabilities. Trump represents some kind of fissures and challenges to the Republican Party in the way that Pence does not. But this is kind of a level of inside, you know, beltway speculation. I don't know the answer to.
I mean, I guess like what I'm talking about is things like Mike Pence is not going to become president with his own security force.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Pence is not going to, and maybe within certain parameters, but not Trumpian level of parameters, even in best case scenario, leverage his position as president to alter, you know, U.S. foreign policy in some instances that I think it's perfectly reasonable to assume that Donald Trump is going to do, right? I mean, in terms of his own family's wealth. I mean, that, and then the question becomes like, you know, how real should we take these notions of authoritarianism and fascism? And I get, obviously, we're not in a position to be able to tell at this point, but is it possible that we won't be able to tell until we realize that we may have taken a fundamentally wrong tact in approaching Donald Trump?
Well, I'm not, when you say the fundamentally wrong, I'm not sure which fundamentally wrong path well, you're talking about. But
if I want to cleave Donald Trump from the Republicans, and I'm willing to say, okay, and I'm willing as the Democratic Party to say, like, okay, we're going to support President Trump in this approach that he has, whatever it is. Let's call it trade policy. We're going to approach him. We're going to prop him up here and argue that he's doing the best thing for the American public, and it's the Republican Party that's standing in front of him. And that brings his popularity level to, let's say, 55%, 60%, 63%. And then we're dealing with a very popular president. And we go down the line and we find out, like, oh, those authoritarian impulses, those were real.
Yeah.
And now he has...
I would definitely not, you know, think that working with Trump is the way to go. And when I talk about the fissures within the Republican Party, it's not so much a recommendation that the Democrats then, you know, pounce on them and try to work with Trump to exacerbate them. I mean, because I think that is a potentially dangerous way. I just don't know if that statement is contingent on any notion of the difference between someone like Pence and Trump. That's really what.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then yes. Okay. I was maybe just trying to use Pence as like a more benign substitute. All right. So give us a sense of the fissures and then how should we approach Trump? Because like I say, my fear has always been that you can approach him as simply a right-wing threat in terms of all the implications of that on our government and our society, or you can approach him as a full-on authoritarian threat, and whether or not those approaches are mutually exclusive.
Well, I mean, I guess what I would say is that he is the leader of a party that is, and he's an outsider to the party, and that's important to remember, without a tremendous amount of popular support, or necessarily, it's not clear yet, institutional support within the party. So, I mean, I think there's just a couple of harbingers or symptoms that we should really be paying a lot more attention to. So I've been following, for instance, the sort of the beginnings of the battle over trade policy. And, you know, Trump, I think probably more than his authoritarianism, more than anything, I think Trump is committed to some kind of fundamental shift on trade policy. And everybody from Paul Ryan to the Club for Growth and all the rest of them have said, no way. Now, the shifts he wants to do on trade policy aren't necessarily in favor of a democratic direction. I mean, it's not like the Democratic Party has been calling for tariffs or something like that. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can approach the question of trade. So it doesn't mean the Democrats have to cooperate with him at all. What I'm going to be interested in is how this starts shaking down between Trump and the party on that issue. And here, I think and I'm sort of working this into an article right now, the real precedent to be looking at is how Jimmy Carter related to the Democratic Party in his one term as presidency. I mean, he came in like Trump. I mean, I know this sounds like an absolutely insane analogy, but there are a lot of similarities there. He came in like a Trump, very much as an outsider to the Democratic Party, first and foremost. He was, you know, there was plenty of movements during the primary, anybody but Jimmy Carter, because he was so challenging the Democratic Party on some of its fundamentals. And I think trade is a fundamental to the Republican Party, and Trump and the party are really at loggerheads. I think the other thing that's really fascinating, frankly, is this ongoing battle between Trump and the security establishment. Mm. I mean, this is really unprecedented. I can't think of anything quite like this in modern American history, where you have, on the one hand, the CIA basically saying that this man was elected with the help of the Russians. And whatever you think about the truth or not of that claim, it doesn't matter. That's what they're, you know, leaking and saying. And you have Trump there railing every night practically on Twitter against the CIA. I mean, we haven't seen anything like this. And it's doubly ironic because, of course, Ronald Reagan got elected in part, you know, because of the strength of the security establishment behind him. These two issues, the whole question about national security and the CIA and the Russia question is caught up in that, and trade are things where Trump is really at loggerheads with his own party. And then on top of that, you know, we've just seen all these challenges to sort of free market orthodoxy that are growing in the population at large. And then, you know, that's going to be a real thing for Trump to have to navigate. So I think there are developing fissures there. Now, what we do about them, I don't quite know. I think the first thing is to attend to them and figure out where they are. Because, you know, Trump thus far, you know, so far he's just been nothing but rhetoric. It's been nothing but speeches. You know, now he's got to rule. And remember, I mean, here's one other thing to keep in mind. I mean, this is probably the most inexperienced administration we have seen, I mean, in modern American politics.
I mean, it's conceivable ever, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even at the birth of the nation, right?
I'd have to go back through some of those late 19th century presidents.
Right.
But it really is kind of incredible. And I don't say this to, you know, kind of make fun of Trump or whatever, but just, you know, when Elaine Chao is your most experienced administrative operative in your cabinet, right? She's got the longest biography. I mean, how you then handle the kinds of political fissures in your own party, right? And then within the government bureaucracy, when you've got the CIA basically in revolt against your own presidency, like that would be a hard thing for any politician to handle, let alone somebody like Trump who has zero government experience and zero political experience. I mean, people like to make the comparison to Hitler all the time, but here, and I think it's an absurd comparison, but here's where it's a useful comparison. Before Hitler came into power, I mean, he had no government experience. He had 10 years of political experience building the largest political party in Weimar Germany. Like, that doesn't just happen, you know, by accident. That took some real political talent. Trump doesn't have any of that. So, you know, you've got all these challenges. You've got an administration that's relatively inexperienced, and you know, some of them are outright government rubes. I mean, remember, George W. Bush had Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, probably the two most talented Republican government operatives, you know, of the last half century on his side. Trump doesn't. So, again, I see lots of weakness and vulnerability there that I think the atmospherics of tweets and he's a monster prevents us from seeing.
Yes, and I agree with that. But let me just press you a little bit on the trade thing. I mean, I have no doubt that Donald Trump has ideas in his head. I don't get the sense that they're fully formed per se. And I think he is guided by what he thinks works at any given moment and where he can sort of exude enough sense of expertise that his audience would buy it. But what makes you think that, like, I mean, one of the things that occurred to me as I was watching, I can't remember what show it was last night, but they were talking about, like, Trump's nominees could be in big trouble with this or that, or, you know, if the deficit balloons, Trump is going to have to somehow deal with his rhetoric from before about deficit. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, there's this presumption that he gives a crap about any of it. Like,
all right, well, yeah, I mean, I think there's two things about that, which, sorry, did you want to say something else?
Well, no, I mean, other than just sort of like, I don't think he really is heavily invested in any of his picks beyond, you know, sort of the way that I might be invested in, you know, I'd like to invite somebody over to my New Year's party. You know, we only get 12 people to sit at the table, and I just want to have nice people around. If they don't show up, I don't think he has a political project.
Right.
That's beyond himself, so I don't think he cares about a lot of things that we assume he should.
So there's a couple things on that. I mean, the first thing on trade is you've got to also look at who he has brought in on his transition team. Now, on the one hand, some of his cabinet appointments were very pro-TPP, so there's that. On the other hand, though, when it comes to people who are making all the appointments on the transition team, he brought in some very hardliners from the steel industry who were veterans of these battles over tariffs and trade with China. So very sort of hardline critics of certain ideas of trade. So I don't think this is just, you know, kind of like his little whim that one day is going to shift and change. He's staffing people around him. And I think that leads, to the second point, which is, you know, trying to mind, you know, read his mind and figure out what's in the soul of Donald Trump is sort of a losing proposition, and not just because it's Trump. I mean, I think that's just true in general for politicians, you know, what really matters to them. But in politics, you set certain things in motion, in part with your words, and you can't always undo them. And it, you may be right that, you know, he doesn't give a crap about what he said, whatever. And sometimes he actually says that. You know, he says, oh, I was just, you know, trying that out or whatever. But sometimes things happen, and you can't undo them. And then they become material realities that you have to really confront and that you start getting hemmed in and caged in by. That's what politics is. You know, you set certain things in motion, and you don't have control over them, and they take on a life of their own. And so this is where, again, I think the politics of fear really undoes us, because we think, right, well, he's sort of beyond, he's beyond the, you know, being held accountable, because he is obviously a person who's completely without shame, which I think is true. But that's not the way politics works. Like, you don't, your personality doesn't get to determine all the rules of the political game. You're subject to certain kinds of constraints. I don't know what they are. I can't tell you and spell it all out. But like I said, things happen on one's watch, and sometimes are set in motion by the things that one says, and then you can't run away from them. They start confronting you and become real realities that you have to confront.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think, you know, on one hand, you're right. There's a total a novice quality to this administration. But guys like Cheney and Rumsfeld, and then I would say even the elder Bush, right? And guys like James Baker, and then the people they staffed in their administration, in their cabinet, all had these institutional constraints, and all had constraints based upon their perceived, either their ideological projects that they wanted to complete, that were motivating their, you know, their presence there, or all of their sort of their ties outside, you know, whether it was Halliburton's, you know, stock portfolio, or,
right,
you know, Rumsfeld,
right,
feeling an attachment to all his friends and the drug companies, or wherever, to a large extent, there's a totally different set of those institutional parameters for Trump, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I mean, he has them, but I think it's just as much like, I want to make sure Ivanka is, like, you know,
yeah,
the richest,
you know, remember,
woman in the world.
What was the lesson we learned from the Obama administration? You know, presidents aren't all powerful.
Right.
You know, and, like, you know, there are, like, the federal bureaucracy is really, really big, you know. To do anything requires, like, getting a lot of these things under control. I think there's certain things that Trump will be able to do easily. And it, as it turns out, those are the things that Republicans always do. Tax cuts and,
right,
deregulation.
Right.
Right. They are primed. It's a machine that they know how to do. Right. But that's normal politics. It has devastating effects. And our job is to be constantly pointing them out and to make them not abstract, but real and concrete. But that's normal Republican politics. That's what he knows how to, that's what they will know how to do. Some of this other stuff is far, far more complicated, particularly when it involves challenging the orthodoxy of your own party, you know. And, you know, it has undone politicians and presidents who were far more talented and far more prepared than Donald Trump. And, you know, again, we have to see and work and do everything we have to do. But I would just caution, particularly people on the left, don't grant him more power than he already has, which is considerable, by treating him as if he is somebody who can suspend all the rules without consequence and who lives above all the rules without consequence.
And so what are there any sort of signposts that you're looking for over the next couple of months that will be indicative of how these fissures are playing out?
Well, I mean, you know, I haven't, there's a couple of things that have already happened that I thought were kind of interesting that, you know, had very little press attention. But so, for instance, you know, they tried to put that questionnaire through to the Department of Energy to find out,
yes,
who basically had a bad position on climate change, and the bureaucracy sort of stood firm and they backed down right away. I mean, I think things like that, I'm actually quite interested with what happens within the bureaucracy on the part of government employees, particularly people who are longtime political, you know, operatives in the federal bureaucracy, to see how they react to different things. You know, I'll be very curious to what's going to happen with the Obamacare thing. You know, we've gotten so many mixed messages from all over the Republican Party and Trump about what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. So that will be, you know, interesting. You know, Trump and his and Kellyanne Conway just said this yesterday again. You know, they do not want to get rid of no pre-existing conditions.
Right.
You know, they've been very firm about that. And, you know, that puts real, you know, if that's the way you go, then your decision to get rid of the mandate and the insurance subsidies becomes a bit of a problem. Then you've got to time it so that it doesn't actually happen until after the next election in order for it, you know, because if you get rid of the mandate and the subsidies, but you keep no pre-existing conditions, what that means is everybody's premiums are going to go skyrocketing.
Right.
And that could have real electoral consequences. So basically, the only way I can see how they could do it is to say, well, we won't do it for 5 years, you know, until after the next election, the next presidential election. Well, that's a long time. So, you know, I'm going to be really interested to see how they negotiate that. I'm also really interested in this whole Tillerson appointment, because clearly the whole Putin issue is something that the Republicans are very divided about. And, you know, McCain and Lindsey Graham, who, you know, I wouldn't trust as far as I could throw because they're very big on rhetoric and not very big on action. But they've said that they want to hold hearings.
Hearings, I think I just saw a report yesterday, are not apparently have just fizzled.
Oh, really?
Yes. And, you know, which is again, and sort of indicative of the, I guess, I mean, maybe more stuff will come out that will sort of reignite their flame. But it seems like that was that's gone by the wayside. I mean, partly is because I think in some respects amongst the elected Republicans in the House and the Senate, Trump is probably more popular than they are to those specific voters.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that could very well be true. I still think that the Tillerson appointment, though, is, I mean, that's from what I understand, that's been the most vulnerable one of all. And so even if those hearings are canceled, I would imagine that the hearings on Tillerson are going to bring out some of the stuff about Russia and all the rest of it. So I think that's something to really to watch. So, yeah, I mean, those are the things, you know, and then where this trade thing goes, you know, and it could just be that he ultimately settles for some, you know, the occasional tweet and, you know, claiming that, you know, Ford is going to return from Mexico and things like that. But, you know, remember, in those states, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, the trade issue was big, you
right.
know. And, you know, I just can't, you know, we'll see how whether or not that lasts.
Yeah, and I guess it's also going to be just to find out how much fun he has in the White House as to whether or not he wants to do a second term. I think, like,
yeah, I mean, he's also quite old, remember?
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, I think there's that as well.
Well, Corey Robin, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Let me just lastly ask you this. Has there ever been a lame duck session, like a period of transition like this that is anything like that? I mean, I missed voting for Reagan the first time around by a couple of weeks, so I can't really recall. But I just wasn't, I think, politically conscious enough to have been aware of it in this detail. But has there ever been one that is so full with I don't know, where there's been so much intensity? It seems like, you know, we're having these conversations. He's not even president yet.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is interesting, but I also think this is what is working against him. You're talking about a president who, in this transition period, has the lowest popularity ratings of anybody since there has been polling, according to Gallup. We have never seen anything like this. You're talking about a president for whom, like, almost fully half the country believes he's illegitimate, just illegitimate off the top. I mean, that's before he's done anything at all. Right? That's what he's coming into. Obama, George W. Bush, even George W. Bush, who was not elected with a popular vote, right?
Yeah.
And was, by many people's accounts, put there just by, you know, the Supreme Court. Even he did not come in with this kind of specter of illegitimacy hanging over him. Not to mention, you know, the CIA saying that you've basically been put here because of the interference of a foreign power. I mean, that's pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, very bizarre time.
Yeah.
Corey Robin, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Strange times.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, you know, on some level, it's just like start the presidency already so we can see how much of a lunatic.
How this actually works.
I mean, you know, I really am still like, you know, for a while I lost this sort of sense of, well, he just doesn't care about any of this stuff. But I don't think he really, I mean, I think he cares about it, but not like, you know.
I think he cares about what he's already achieved, which is money, further opportunities for self-enrichment, double dealing.
I think there's the
power.
I think there's that. I think there's this sort of like, I've got to maintain. I just don't think he has, he cares, but I just don't think that he has a political program. And, you know, which is not even to say like he lacks an ideological program, because I think to a large extent, not totally, but to a large extent, Obama lacked an ideological.
Well, there's a distinction between post-ideology and pre-ideology.
Well, I think Obama had a political program that was about process. Like, I'm going to make America, you know, like the American government, something that everyone have pride in. And I think that Trump, I know he wants to make America great again, but I'm also not convinced, you know, like, not unlike Trump University, or anything else that he's hawked, that it's just not enough for it to be to appear to be great.
I think that's the greatest lesson. Like, it's fun to make fun of his steaks and his orange face and everything, but Trump University is so excellent because it fits right at the intersection of everything you need to know about him. Like,
I just
con man.
Wants
promoter,
to be provost of a university?
Like, literally.
I'm a president of a university.
He wants that title.
And it's a great university.
And that's what upset him so much about, like, you could tell, like, his aggrievement wasn't even as much worry about, like, charges or paying fines. I mean, I'm sure he was worried about that. But just the notion that, like, they're besmirching the name of a fine establishment of higher education. That really matters to him.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see if his trade stuff, because, you know, the things that constrain a president are, you know, I mean, it seems to me, all the people you've surrounded yourself with who have their own constraints, their own agendas that are going to go forward after their president, the institutions that surround them, even the training and experience you had up to that moment carries through, right? Like, my parents are still an institutional constraint on me because of the way they raised me when I was, you know, four. I mean, I try and break free from a lot of that, but
well, but not so much.
No, but not
clearly,
so much.
Yeah,
but
do you? Yeah,
and Trump doesn't have any of those, and I don't think he even has. Like, I think he has. Like, he wants to be seen. He wants to be a legacy that is popular, but I don't think for him that translates into actually taking specific political actions as much as putting them whatever happens in the best light.
Well, I think that though that is why you see very specific concerns about things like getting rid of pre-existing conditions, because you can't really put that in a good light.
Right.
And that is where there's vulnerability. The other thing that I just wanted to note really quick is there were studies that I looked at in college, and it was basically they were measuring crisis messages versus, I think they called it empowerment messages, which regards to collective action problems like climate change. And it reminded me of what Corey was talking about, because if you went full crisis, like,
people give up.
Not only do they give up, they actually accelerate the behavior. Like, if the test models were like, this pond is about to be depleted of fish, and it's going to be gone in a second because of everything we're doing.
People are just like, I'm grabbing the last fish.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, if you went completely like, eh, don't worry about it, people were responsible too. And it was always in the middle message of like,
say,
critical danger,
my bourbon,
but we can take care
of it.
Vodka
consumption,
exactly.
And cookie consumption,
yes,
over the past, since the election, has been at an all-time high.
I at least from my angle, I can see it.
No, it's...
I'm glad that no one can see it on YouTube.
It's crazy. I'm dialing it back.
Not good. Well, you need, right, you need to have some empowerment messages.
That's right.
Exactly.
I can... I don't need all that. I don't need that chocolate chip.
Your gut
caramel
is at
salted,
a critical point, and it's an emergency.
Chocolate chip,
and it's
salted
a mess,
cookie.
And it's a
I know
disaster.
Exactly where it is in our kitchen right. right now, too.
It's okay. Clearly, this is past the point of no return.
This. Yeah.
I wanted to say a while back when you were saying about the superficiality of Trump's goals for the country, you know, make America look great again. It really goes to the infrastructure plan being something that he's really big on, and really all that I've read that he's really said about that is that our airports look like shit.
Right.
And that it really just says so much about the way that he thinks, when he thinks at all, you know, that's what... That's how the infrastructure plan came to mind. Someone said infrastructure to him, and he was like, yeah,
well,
the airports
goes through
look
LaGuardia
like shit.
It's like, this is a pain in the
no,
ass.
No, but I think that's also one of the only areas that he actually knows. Like, he knows real estate to some extent, obviously, and he knows infrastructure. And I think his frames of reference for those things are like, I know how to, like, bilk city contracts.
Right.
And I know how to, like, get cement from people that might be affiliated with
certain
organizations.
Well, he also probably looks at this
stuff
and says,
like that.
I've done all the bilking.
Yes.
And the padding of the budgets. So that's one area I know, and I can add value because I can say, like, I can tell this is 10% too high.
Exactly. And that's also why, I always say that to me, in some ways, Ben Carson's
why
the most terrifying
the guys who are working
appointment
you?
Because it's not like, it's not, right, exactly. It's not just that let's have, like, all of the appointments are, let's appoint somebody to destroy what the department does. But in Ben Carson's case, like, I would imagine that Donald Trump has some very specific plans for HUD that might have some very specific overlap with his very specific interests. And then you have someone there who you could just say, hey, this is the biblical approach to HUD.
On top of it.
I'm on top of it. I got
it. All right.
It.
We're going to take a break and head into the fun half. Folks, it's your membership that makes this show possible. Become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. What do you get? You get an extra, I don't know, 45 minutes, hour and a half. It depends on what we've got to do later in the afternoon. Sometimes 2 hours. God, what do you want out of me? And
take more and more.
Also, you get the show... what do you call it? Commercial free, which is good. Sometimes we have no commercials. Sometimes we have 2, 3, 4 commercials. I mean, we don't generally, but sometimes it's possible, theoretically possible. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And what else do I got for you? Oh, you want to gift the show? You can gift the show. MajorityGift.com. Don't forget, if you haven't subscribed to our YouTube channel, go do that. Give us a rating on iTunes. We'll be back in the fun half in just a moment.